This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross, who's a little under the weather today. Well, the holidays are over, and you know what comes next. The credit card bills for all the spending and overspending you did over the past few weeks. But the purchases themselves aren't the only way you may have spent too much money. According to today's guest, author Bob Sullivan, the credit card companies may be eating into your wallets and purses with all their hidden fees and charges. And that goes for the car dealerships and the cell phone service providers, too. Bob Sullivan is a reporter for MSNBC.com covering computer crime and consumer affairs. He appears regularly on the NBC Nightly News, The Today Show, and the MSNBC cable network. He's the author of the bestseller Gotcha Capitalism, and his new book is called Stop Getting Ripped Off: Why Consumers Get Screwed and How You Can Always Get a Fair Deal. Terry spoke with Bob Sullivan recently to ask about some of these hidden consumer traps and how to avoid them.
Bob Sullivan, welcome back to Fresh Air. The credit card bills for the Christmas gifts are on the way, so let's start there. For people who've spent more than they can pay off in full, what suggestions do you have about how to handle your credit card?
You know, the sticker shock for Christmas really comes right about now. This is the unwrapping that's very unpleasant. It's a good time to talk about this, though, because there are really three different kinds of credit card users, as I see it. There's users who always pay their bill off every month on time in full. There's users who owe a lot and are revolvers, and they get a lot of attention, too. But in between are people who occasionally spend more than they can afford in a particular month. I call them Christmas card users, and that's what we have here. So people who generally pay their bill on time and don't really know about this complicated world of revolving debt and late fees and over-limit fees, this will all be a surprise to them. The most important thing is, even though there's the dreaded click you just don't want to do today, you don't want to see what your balance is on that credit card, go ahead and do it. It's always better to know. It's like when you see the doctor, you always feel better. When there's a diagnosis, click on that link, see what the balance is, and deal with it. And if it's something you can't pay in full this month, that's okay. But what I want you to do, and most folks don't do this, is whatever card you have that's now beyond what you can pay this month, stop using that immediately, because you will continue to incur interest charges into February and into March as long as you don't pay that bill off. Most folks just keep ringing and ringing and ringing. Use a second card. If you don't have a second card, hopefully you planned ahead for this, or use a card with no balance. I call this the clean card strategy. And begin using only that card, a card that you know you will pay off. So now you might have one card with a balance, and I'll call that your line of credit card, where you're paying interest, but you're going to pay it down. You'll know exactly what the debt is. But then the other side is a card where you still have that free loan from the credit card company. You won't be paying any interest on your day-to-day purchases. And keep those separate. That's the best way to attack this big mountain of debt you might have incurred during December.
And you also suggest that if you owe money, pay some in the middle of the billing cycle. Don't wait for the bill to come. Will you be paying less interest if you pay off some of it midway through the cycle?
A lot of folks miss this point. Once you get to that different universe where you haven't paid your bill and the interest comes, credit card companies often charge on what's called the average daily balance. Every single day they add to your interest pile. People by instinct just wait for another bill to come to pay. You don't have to do that. If you can't pay your bill at the end of January, but your next paycheck comes on February 12th, go ahead and pay it then. You'll save yourself half the interest you would have paid. Doing that as a regular habit can save someone who spends an average amount of money on Christmas a good $60 or $70 in interest. So just don't wait for the bill. Pay it as soon as you have the money.
Okay, in keeping with this theme that people are maxed out financially because of holiday spending, let's get to checking accounts and debit cards. A lot of people might have overextended their debit cards and their checking accounts, and you have a lot to say about this. Let's start with debit cards. You really recommend against debit cards.
I think it's a terrible idea to spend money with debit cards for a lot of reasons. The biggest one is that once upon a time, debit cards were considered safer than credit cards because you were spending your own money. But the banks that issued these cards realized they were losing money that way, and so they added all these fees, the most significant being this overdraft fee, which you've heard so much about. It's very, very easy to overdraw your checking account using a debit card. And once you do that, it's very easy to ring up 6, 7, 8 of these charges. So that hamburger could cost you $200 or $300. And especially if you've already spent a lot and now you're kind of near the edge of your checking account once you pay your bills this month, you don't want to be close you don't even want to give yourself the near occasion of ending up with an overdraft fee because they almost always cascade. That's a big headache. But in a larger sense, what I'm really against is people using their main checking account, the place where their paychecks are deposited once or twice a month, and they write the big checks in their lives, the mortgage, the car payment. I'm really against people swiping their debit card and getting money from an ATM and cluttering up those accounts with 30 or 40 transactions every month. You're just bound to trip up when you do that. This is called velocity in the banking world. And the more velocity you have, the more opportunities there are for a mistake. So I believe in separating your accounts out. You want to have an account that you use just for those big things. I call this the staging account, where you deposit your paychecks, you write the big checks, so you always have a grasp of what's in there. Again, I'm a really big fan of people having a good general grasp of their financial picture all the time. So that's one account. And the second account is an allowance account. And that's the one you use for everyday petty cash purchases, if you will, if you really need to use a debit card. And again, I'm not for that, but people do it. So separate out all those ticky-tack transactions. Make sure that's a card with no overdraft fee on it. You can call up the bank now and you can say, don't allow me to overspend this account. So when the money's gone, it's gone, and you'll know that. And by doing this, you'll really simplify your financial life. That checking account right now has become a do-everything account, and that's a problem for a lot of people.
So in a checking account, you're definitely going to get slapped with a fee if you overdraw on it, whereas on a debit card, you can say, if I'm out of money, just don't let the transaction go through. And
that's
you won't
correct,
you won't be charged any kind of fee. But you have to ask for that, because otherwise they give you the overdraft protection, make it seem like it's a big favor to you.
Right. Yeah, the courtesy overdraft protection is automatic on most checking accounts in America today. That's going to change. There's been a lot of new regulations about overdraft, and we're still in the middle of sorting all that out. But for the time being, assume you have it, and even if you don't know it, you're already automatically set up to get a loan from your debit card just by swiping it at a store or sometimes even at an ATM. You'll get cash from a machine even if you don't have any. So you got to ask the bank directly to remove what's called courtesy overdraft protection, and then you'll be in much more solid foundation.
So just to clarify, there are times I think when the courtesy overdraft protection is very useful. Like if your checking account is linked to your savings account, and your savings account has enough money to cover any overdraft from your checking account, it prevents a check from bouncing. You still will get slapped with like a $10 transfer fee maybe, but it's better than the larger fee that you'd get for bouncing a check, and also you don't want to bounce a check.
You know, sadly, we've gotten into a nomenclature problem here, which is exactly what the banks want. So courtesy overdraft protection refers exclusively to this automatic protection that you get, whether you want it or not. That's going to cost you $35 a pop. The best alternative after you've figured out this not to do that is to link your accounts, as you're suggesting. You can link a savings account or even line of credit to your debit card. The fee will be much less for that. That usually goes by another name, just simply overdraft protection or some other name at the bank.
I see.
So, but the confusion is intentional on the bank's part. But the rule of thumb is if you're borrowing your own money, it's relatively cheap. If you're borrowing the bank's money, it's very expensive.
So if you have a debit card and you have that courtesy overdraft protection, they're basically giving you a loan and you're paying interest on the money they're giving you.
Well, that's a big debate. The banks don't describe it that way. They see it as just a fee-based service. And because it's only a fee-based service, they don't have to do things like publish what the annual percentage rate would really be. All the consumer groups argue that it is a loan service and, in fact, was invented directly to compete with things like payday loans. And again, at $35 for a $3 overcharge, the interest rate can be four digits.
Right, right. It's so hard to keep track of all of this. Like, you have to just be a full-time student in order to understand your bills and your banking system.
Yeah, that's my concern. I mean, people who are good at this, people who think this is kind of a game, and I'll confess I'm one of them, usually do okay in this world. But, you know, regular people out there, they're busy raising kids, taking care of parents, trying to get by at work, trying to find a job. This should not require top-of-mind concern every day. Unfortunately, it does. There are a lot of books out there. There are a lot of people who discuss how to get rich quickly, and I don't do any of that. But what I'm convinced of is that if what you do in life now, in your financial life, is you just don't get screwed by a bank when you're buying a house or you don't get screwed by a financial advisor, you know, you're not going to get rich, but you're actually going to be pretty okay. And that boils right down to this topic. If you're not losing $35 every couple of weeks to one of these fees, You'll make it through the year pretty okay, and that's what I want for people.
Bob, you say the idea of a free checking account is largely a charade now.
A free checking account is a charade, and actually it'll be very interesting to see what happens over the next 12 months. If I could just backtrack a little bit to credit cards, when that Credit Card Protection Act was passed earlier this year, we saw an incredible chain reaction. There are all these new consumer protections, but on came all these bullets fired by the banks. They raised people's interest rates. Half of America saw their rates either go up or their credit limits go down, the banks say, as a result of a loss of revenue from the new credit card protections. Well, new checking account protections are going to come in this year, and the big ominous threat we've heard from banks is that free checking, quite literally, will disappear. They will start having to charge annual fees, which happened long ago, for checking accounts. Now, what I would say to that is that exposes the sham all along, because what we've had is a system where a third of the country or so who paid overdraft fees last year, they pay a lot for checking accounts. They might pay $200, $300, $400 a year in fees when it's all added up. And those people subsidize other people who, at least this year, didn't make a mistake, and they're not slipping up. Now, that's more like a parlor game to me than a product. And that's what we've been going through. You know, when all those fees are taken away, if there is a $5 annual fee or something like that that comes from checking accounts, that will be really unfortunate. But at least the banks will have to honestly price their product, and now we'll actually be competing with each other on price, and consumers can see for themselves what the real cost of their account is.
How much of those checking account fees will be taken away with the new legislation?
Well, some of the overdraft fees will be taken away. Some of them will be capped. The courtesy overdraft protection will be the ability to remove it will be much easier. In some cases, they won't be able to add it at all to accounts. And there's some pretty dire predictions from the banking industry. I saw one lobbyist say he expects hundreds of banks to fail just because overdraft fees have been eliminated. Once again, my response to that would be, if your business can't survive without these punishment fees, well, you probably don't have much of a business.
Why is the banking system in a position where it's getting its money from fees?
This is a story that has a very sad ending at the moment. The product of banks is loaning money. That's their business. They loan money, they borrow money from the federal government, they loan it out at a slightly higher rate, and that's how they make money. That was how they made money. But over the past 15 years, banks have slowly realized that, in bank terminology, they wanted to diversify their revenue streams. The margins on interest rates have gotten lower and lower. The margins on loans have gotten lower. And they went into this world of fees. But one real benefit to that is that there are far fewer regulations on fees than on interest. When credit cards in particular moved into this world of fees, there actually was a Supreme Court decision that allowed banks to add fees and to charge rates that were unregulated by any of the state authorities and largely unregulated by federal authorities as well. So fees are a much easier way for them to make money than complicated interest products where they had to disclose a lot of information. And now there are many banks that make more than half of their income from fees instead of interest, which a lot of folks, I'd be at the top of the list, argue means the banking is no longer serving the function for the American consumers that it's designed to do, which is to help create this multiplier effect on the economy. All they're doing is sucking money out of the economy without a multiplier, and that's really bad business.
So I remember the days when you actually got rewarded. You got interest for having money in the bank. Now they charge you. They charge you to get your own money out.
Well, you know, this is a key issue I would like to address. It almost never gets brought up. The Fed has kept interest rates incredibly low for a very long time now, and this is the second time we've done this in the last decade. And in general, the stock market loves that. Banks like it because they can loan money cheaply. And if you're in the market for a house, it's probably good for you. But if you are a saver, if you're a conservative financially with your money, a lot of older folks, what they do in order to provide income to themselves is they have CDs that they roll over every month or every 3 months. It's killing people like that. Savings accounts are almost worthless in America right now. And we have this long stretch where interest earnings are basically gone. And we've essentially picked winners and losers in the marketplace by having these low interest rates. We're trying to make winners out of people who want to invest in houses and invest in stocks. But right now, losers out of people who saved a lot of money, who you think should be getting gold stars right now, given what's happened with the economy.
So you mentioned legislation that's going to affect the fees that banks can charge consumers. Yes. What law is that?
Well, there's two things happening at once. The Federal Reserve is actually issuing new regulations. It's in the process of doing that as we speak. And the Congress is considering overdraft protections that will go into law, which will prevent banks from automatically charging people fees and automatically giving people this tool that they never wanted in the first place. And it will provide a few other containers on how many fees banks can charge, even if you do opt to have that protection. The number of fees that can be charged in a single day, for example, will be limited. And all those are good protections. Remains to be seen how banks will react to that and whether they will follow through on a threat of adding other fees instead. I can bet they'll try. And that's where I think consumers really need to pay attention in the first couple of months of this year, because their checking accounts may change substantially.
So keep an eye open for new fees?
Absolutely. One of the things to really keep an eye open for with all these mergers, a lot of folks who had an account that was free with one bank, after they were acquired by another bank and the logos changed on their bills and on their credit cards, suddenly noticed the free account they had is now a fee account with the new bank, because their minimum balance with the old bank was $1,000, but now their new minimum balance is $2,000. And those things change, and it's very easy to miss them if you don't look. So if you've gone through a merger, or just, you know, as you're listening to what's happening with the Federal Reserve and its new rules, make sure you look at that bank statement for new fees.
Let's look some more at credit cards. New legislation has been taking effect over a period of time, slowly getting implemented, that regulates what credit card companies can do in terms of fees and other ways of getting money out of you. So what are some of the things that we should be looking out for now in our credit card bills, now that the law has changed and is continuing to change? There are some tricks that the companies can't use anymore. Are there new tricks that they're substituting?
Yeah, there's two really important new tricks which have already hurt a lot of people. One is to raise the minimum payment requirements. Some banks have raised that payment from 2 to 5%, which might not sound like a lot, but there are plenty of folks out there who took credit cards or transferred balances to credit cards with the expectation that they would be able to get by paying $200, $300 a month for the next 5 or 6 years to get out of a loan. Well, all of a sudden, that $300 a month bill is now a $750 a month bill. That's killing people. And the credit card legislation said nothing about minimum payments. I think, frankly, Congress didn't even think of that as a potential consequence.
Can I stop you right there for a second? So,
yeah.
So the problem with that is if you can't meet the minimum payment, then you're paying interest on a lot more money than...
Well,
no, that's not it. That's not it. What?
Yeah, wait, there's even bigger problems.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, you.
There's a lot of problems. Here's what I think is going on with the minimum payment thing. A lot of banks gave these very aggressive transfer offers to consumers. So they might say, you know, we'll give you a 5% interest rate for 10 years on any balances that you transfer in. Well, now they have these terrible loans on their books, and they're raising the minimum payment to smoke out these consumers, basically. So if a person who was paying $300 a month now has a $750 a month bill and they can't pay it, well, now they call the credit card company up and they get some really bad options. We'll lower your minimum payment down if you let us raise your rate, or we're going to just put you into default so we can raise your rate to the default rate, so that 3.9% rate suddenly goes to 30%. I've talked to people who've had this happen. It's devastating. And these are people who haven't done anything wrong, who've paid their bills as described for sometimes years. But just by changing those terms, the banks can create all of these effects. So the changing the minimum payment balance has really hurt a certain set of consumers. But the other thing is lowering the credit limits. And again, I think folks who don't normally spend up to their credit limits, which is better than half of America, they might not think of this as a terrible consequence, but it really can be. A large part of your credit score is based on what's called your credit usage formula. And so if you're a kind of consumer, you have a couple of credit cards with a $5,000 limit, and you never get anywhere near that, that's considered you having $10,000 in available credit. Well, let's say that's cut by 3/4, which could happen. Now you've only got $2,500 in available credit, and maybe you do spend up to that. So when some company pulls your credit report, it looks like you're using all your credit. Now you look like a big risk. So it can hurt your credit score a lot, 30, 40, 50 points, just having a credit card company lower your credit limit. And in turn, that kind of score can put you from having a prime loan to a subprime loan. That can have you at the car dealership getting a 9% interest rate rather than a 5 or 6% interest rate. So lowering your credit limits is actually can actually be a really big problem. And if consumers have had that happen to them, they've got to address it in one way or another. The best way is to get another credit card, which sounds like crazy advice from someone who's not so hot on credit cards. But you have to really replace that missing credit that you had. So if companies have lowered your credit limit, you should start shopping around for another credit card or two that will give you back that money so you have that limit and that credit back in your life.
Let's move on to cell phones. And I love an expression you use in your book. You describe cell phone owners as prisoners of their cell phone company. Why do you say that?
Well, almost everybody who uses a cell phone is in some kind of a long-term contract. And it's really hard to find a parallel in your life, although the cable folks and the satellite TV folks are starting to catch on to this business model. But it's hard to find a parallel in your life where you might have this product that you use and you're stuck with it for 2 years, especially at a time now where there are all these great new cell phones and these great new technologies coming out. And there's a lot of real competition in the high end of smartphones that can do all of these amazing things and get email and get you online from anywhere. But most folks are stuck in a contract that they don't want, and they can't shop for those new phones. They can't shop for new prices. One good thing about competition is that the price for things like all-you-can-eat cell phone calling and texting continues to get lower, so new customers can enjoy those things. But if you're in a contract, you're really out of luck. There's been a little bit of return from the cell phone companies in that now they don't charge you the full fee if you get out of your contract. They charge what they call a prorated fee, although it's not quite that. But recently, Verizon's early termination fees exploded on some phones to $350. So if you sign up with Verizon for a service and you want to get out of it because something happens, including, by the way, if your service isn't working, they'll charge you $350 to return that phone and for you to be a free agent again. That's a crazy business model. It just doesn't allow people to shop around and get the best deal.
Sometimes the way you end up getting into one of those long-term contracts is that you get a great deal on the telephone itself. Mm-hmm. If you sign for the, you know, two-year contract. So it seems like, yeah, you know, you're saving me a lot of money on the phone. Sure.
You know, the model that where the cell phone companies give you something at a discounted price and then expect to make that money back from you over time, there's nothing wrong with that. That's essentially a loan, right? They're going to charge you over time to pay them back for their subsidy. And if that's what they were doing and if that was declared clearly, well, I think that'd be great. But that's not how it works. All these fees are arbitrary. They don't have any relationship to the amount of subsidy that you got when you bought that phone. The amount of the proratedness doesn't decline anything near the same as the amortization of the gadget itself. And so they're really just kind of gaming the system. But the most important thing to me here is that they are distorting the actual price of the gadget. Verizon right now has incredibly low prices on their smartphones because they have these incredibly high early termination fees. And once again, instead of charging people the real price for the gadget, they're hiding the real price and making a few people subsidize that very low price. It's a distorted strategy that doesn't allow for true competition in the marketplace. I would be much happier if all these companies just charged the real price for the phone or charged some price and then said, over the next 2 years, you're going to pay us back for the rest of this phone, and everybody knew what they cost. Then we could really compare and compete. When we can't compare and compete directly, everybody loses, including, in my opinion, not just the consumers, but the companies too. Companies that want to be clear about the price for their things, they can't compete if somebody else is subsidizing their price by charging these high back-end fees on other customers. It's not a fair marketplace.
Is Verizon alone in doing that, or all the companies doing that?
No, all the cell phone companies do. Some of the fees aren't as high, but I suspect other companies will follow Verizon's lead on those expensive smartphones. They'll almost certainly have to if Verizon can get away with it for a long time. But all the companies have these early termination fees, and none of them are particularly clear.
So we've been talking about credit card fees and bank fees. Cell phones have fees that you have to be careful of in your bill. I suppose it's worthwhile to sometimes really study the bill before you pay it. Yeah, what are some of the things you think we should watch out for in our cell phone bills?
You know, it's very worthwhile studying your cell phone bills. I have never met a person whose cell phone bill was the same 1 month to the next. There's something always different on the bill. Things to look for is how much you're paying for the add-on services like text messaging, whether or not you might have accidentally used a web service that you don't normally use. Premium text messaging is a really sinister problem, especially with kids. There are certain kind of texts that cost a lot more than others. Premium texts can cost a dollar or two apiece. You sign up with a special ringtone service or maybe a dating service. And next thing you know, I talked to a dad whose daughter had rung up $10,000 in premium text message fees in 1 month.
Wow.
And you know, again, you just have to ask the question, how can you put something in the hand of a child that could end up ringing up a $10,000 bill?
How do you avoid doing that?
That goes off?
Like, what recommendations would you have to parents who have children with cell phones?
You know, we live at a time where a lot of folks feel very comfortable with their kids having cell phones, and I understand why. The age where you give a kid a cell phone is a very personal decision, I think, for parents. There are very good limited cell phone products, which I wish more parents would consider. You can give a kid a phone that only calls a few numbers. A lot of phone companies have plans they don't advertise a lot, where you can get a regular phone and limit their options, limit their number of minutes, so the phone stops working except for mom's number at a certain time in the month. Those kinds of caps are a great idea. Parents really should look into that. I don't think it makes any sense to give a child who's not even old enough to earn any kind of a paycheck yet a device where they can ring up thousands of dollars in bills.
Now, another thing you recommend is that if you renew your contract, look out on your bill for upgrade fees. What
Yes.
kind of fees should you be looking out for?
Well, everybody knows that if you break your contract, you're going to have to pay a fee. But what a lot of folks don't know is that if you renew your contract, if you're loyal to your cell phone company, you'll almost certainly also have to pay a fee. So you really can't win there. These are called upgrade fees. And if you get a new phone, even if the phone is free, almost all the carriers will charge you an upgrade fee, and it can be $36. And it often doesn't arrive until a good 2 months after you've gotten the new phone. So you have to look line by line on the phone to see this. This is a fee, by the way, for attaching that new phone to the network. That should be part of the phone. When you buy the phone and you get a contract, the price of putting you on the network certainly should be included and could be included in the handset. But again, they're just trying to distort the price to reel you in.
One of the chapters in your new book is about buying a car. And buying a car has really changed in the internet era. And you suggest price shopping through emailing dealerships before actually going out and meeting people and, you know, sitting in the office and making the deals. So how do you shop effectively by email when you're looking for a car?
Well, let me make a distinction first between the new car and the used car market. The new car market is actually a nearly perfect market nowadays for consumers, a perfectly functioning market. Because the good news is if you really want a new Jeep Liberty, the Jeep Liberty you'll buy at dealer A will be identical to the one you'll buy at dealer B and C, and so you can have them all compete with each other. That's great for you, really bad for the dealership. But nevertheless, they want your business. Now, I would never recommend simply buying it online. But I go to a dealer, drive one, pick out the car you want, and leave. The most important thing is to leave because they're going to do everything they can to keep it from going out the door. But get a price, leave, and then call. The best thing to do is really to email 4 or 5 different dealers. And it's really critical that you go out of your immediate area. A lot of folks never consider that they can go buy a car 60 miles away. But you certainly can when it's a once-every-5-year purchase. It's sure worth it to at least investigate that. Prices do vary by market. I mean, you just send a simple email that says, I'm in the market for this car, these options, this is the price I have, can you beat it? So that's a really good start. However, a really critical part of what happens in the car buying process, because obviously the competition is now intense, is after you've got a deal, that's when the wheels really start spinning in the finance office. If you're going to try to finance the car directly with the dealer, there's all sorts of expenses that can be added at that point. Things like license and tags can be far too expensive and over. That's how they make a lot of profit. There's fees that are cropping up on bills of sale now for cars that we never saw before. In addition to advertising fees and dealer holdbacks, there's all sorts of other things that they're adding just to try to get money. So understand that there's a big difference between the price and what sometimes is known as the OTD price or the out-the-door price at the dealer. Got to get that out-the-door price. That's the one that matters.
Now, you said, like, shop out of your area if you're getting a cheaper price. Drive an hour away. The problem I always see with that is that they always tell you when you buy a car that while the car is under warranty, you should really have it. You should really bring it to a dealership. Now, I suppose you could bring it to a different dealer than you bought it at, but what are your thoughts on servicing the car while it's under the warranty?
There's no reason to bring the car to the dealership during the warranty. A lot of dealers will imply that the warranty is void if you have it serviced outside of a dealership. That's
They will just come out and say that if it's not at a dealership, there's no way of really proving that the work that was done on your car is adequate. And they could just say, the people who serviced your car didn't do a good job, so we're not honoring your warranty.
That's not legally true. They cannot discriminate over who fixes your car. They can certainly encourage you. And I've heard it said even more forcefully when people finance their cars through dealers. Well, they will intimate you have to do your warranty work. I've heard outright lies where not only do you have to have the warranty work done here, but you have to buy an extended warranty because you're financing the car with us, because the financing extends beyond the normal warranty price. And that's not true. This is where dealers make all their money in these aftercharges. Now, it often is a good idea to have the work done by the dealer. It can be done by any dealer. There's no reason not to do that. And I don't necessarily discourage people from doing that. But it's always important in any transaction, I think cars more than anywhere, whenever somebody says to you, you have to do this, you can't negotiate this price, that's the price, well, that's a trap. That's not true. And you always want to have some kind of price force on all of these things we're talking about. And the dealer says to you, you know, you got to come back here to have the work done. Well, it's not true.
Now, you advise never negotiate over the monthly payments. Negotiate over the total price.
Yeah, this is a really critical element. The first thing almost any car salesperson will ask you when you walk in is, what can you afford a month? And just don't answer. That's the biggest trap that they have. Because the way that they pack your car loan with all sorts of extra fees is because it's going to be very, very confusing at the end exactly what you're paying for. What you want is a price. You want the bottom line out-the-door price. That's the only tool you have to make sure you're paying the right amount. Now, one thing that I really like to talk about connected with this book and all transactions, cars is a really good example of it, is when you're sitting down at the dealer and you think you're paying $300 a month and then they come back with, well, we added sales tax and so on and now it's $369 a month. Most consumers at that point are overwhelmed. It's an emotional decision. For a lot of people, it really is a once-in-a-lifetime or two or three times-in-a-lifetime transaction. So you're all worked up. You can't do the numbers very well in your head. And you better believe it, the guy on the other side of the desk or the woman on the other side of the desk, they know the numbers much better than you do.
Mm-hmm.
And they're probably going to pack them. And it's much, much easier when you're dealing with a monthly payment, which is almost abstract, for them to pack that with something that you don't know. I'll tell you what happened to me last time I bought a car. I often put myself into these perilous transactions just to see what happens. Things that people dread, I do for fun. It's a disease, I think. But I walked in, exactly what happened. It should have been about $330 a month, and it was $370 a month, and I questioned the number, and they sort of shrugged and said the numbers all added up. Well, what had happened was there was a $2,000 rebate on the car, which they had mathematically forgotten to subtract from the price when they did the calculation. Now, let me tell you that I've bought four new cars since I've been an adult. There has been a mathematical error in every single transaction. I know this is a small sample size.
I can see quotation marks around the word error.
That's right. These are intentional errors. And in the book, I create an actual mythical transaction just to give people the sense of what it's like. But again, if you're sitting there, it's easy to tell, wait a minute, the price should be $22,000. It's really $24,000. But if we're talking about, you know, $330 a month versus $355 a month, you could easily miss that. That's why you just don't want to have that conversation. The best way to get around that is to show up with a check from your bank. Banks will give you these. You already are approved for a loan for this amount. And you can sign that check over to the dealer. So it's essentially a cash deal. It's as if you brought your own money, which, of course, sometimes can be best to buy the car. So you just cut out all of those negotiations. That's the best way.
Are you likelier to get a better interest rate from the bank than you are from the car dealer?
You know, you can often get a better interest rate from the car dealer. They might have special deals with the bank. So it's okay to ask. Understand when you get into dealer financing that you're in a danger zone, but you know, we can handle that. Just do the math ahead of time so you know what you're getting into. I know this sounds aggressive, but it's a good way to do things. Last time I bought a car, I bought in a laptop computer and it had a spreadsheet in it with all the numbers already figured out. And the guy gave me a new hiccup like they often do. Oh, the sales tax is really this. Or, you know, I just added that into my spreadsheet to double check his work. And, you know, he understood what I was doing.
I'm sure he loved it.
Yeah. I'm often not popular once I leave these places. But come with a loan already in your back pocket. That could put you in a much stronger negotiating point. And then after all this is done and after you've got a piece of paper with a price on it, well, go ahead and say, here's what I have. Can you beat it? And the dealer would want to because they get a cut out of those loans, of course. So they'll do their best to beat the loan, and it's worth asking. But again, do so with your eyes wide open, knowing it could be a trap.
Let me ask you, you are like Mr. Excellent Consumer. Like, you really know your way around. And you're really good at math, and you bring your laptop computer when you need to do the calculations so you can keep up with the person on the other end of the desk or the other end of the phone. Do you get it taken advantage of anyways?
All the time. You know, I'm actually not Mr. Excellent Consumer. I hate confrontation. That's why I became a journalist. There are people, and I think we all know them, who just have a big booming voice or they just have a way about them that makes them intimidate other folks, and they rarely get ripped off because folks just don't want to do that to them. I'm a pretty mild-mannered guy, and I just like a lot of other folks, I think people see me as an easy mark when I start. I think that actually helps my reporting a lot because I'm soft-spoken and probably on the gentle side of the spectrum. Immediately, car dealers and whatnot see me as a potential victim. But the thing that always works, and I would really urge this for consumers, I actually don't know all the consumer. I don't have a law degree. I wish I did in this area. It's actually very hard to get a consumer law degree. There aren't consumer law textbooks. But what I do know is that when I throw out one or two facts about this transaction, I don't have to know everything, but if I know one or two laws, I know there's Regulation E, which governs banking and means the bank has to give me a refund if I didn't actually withdraw the money. And I know there's laws if you pay for an extended warranty and you don't on a car and you don't want it within most states within 3 days, you can show up with a letter and get an instant refund. You show you know a little bit, most salespeople back off. So a little bit of knowledge, you know, throw that out at the very beginning. It usually tells people that you're on one side of the spectrum rather than the other. You're a smart consumer, not a victim. Get that message across and you'll probably do pretty well.
I want to just close with one last piece of advice that you give in your book. And you say, call your cable company at least every 6 months and ask for a lower rate. is that actually effective?
Yeah, it's incredibly effective. It might be the most effective thing consumers can do right now. Thank the Lord, thank whoever you want to thank. Competition in pay television is here now. For a lot of folks, for years, all they could do was subscribe to one cable provider and put up with whatever they were charged. Nowadays, not only is there satellite and Fios, but there's also the internet and all these programs that are free on Hulu. And if you haven't tried it yet, do sometime this month, unplug your cable box or your satellite from your TV and let your TV work off an antenna. Those new HD signals we talked so much about and that conversion, which was such a crisis, well, the picture's great, let me tell you. There's a lot of good programs that you can get for free. I'm not telling anyone they should cancel their cable tomorrow, although there's a great website called cancelcable.com, which offers people a great TV guide for how to see almost everything you normally watch on TV on the internet. The fact that there's alternatives gives you great bargaining power. So, yeah, you need to call your cable company or your satellite provider, whoever you pay, every 6 to 12 months with an ad in hand from a competitor, and say, what can you do for me? I hear people every day who have saved $50, $60, $70 a month just for making one phone call. That's probably the most valuable call consumers can make right now.
Well, Bob Sullivan, thank you so much. It's been great to talk with you. Thank you, and I wish you a very good 2010.
Well, thank you very much.
Bob Sullivan speaking to Terry Gross. His new book is called Stop Getting Ripped Off, Why Consumers Get Screwed and How You Can Always Get a Fair Deal. The music of trumpeter and composer Wadada Leo Smith ranges from solo recitals to works for chamber orchestra and for various small improvising units. Smith has 3 recent albums, 2 reissues, and a new set of live concert recordings by 2 of his bands. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Smith's music can be highly abstract, but often carries a whiff of the blues. Thank you.
trumpeter Wadada Leo Smith from his reissued 1979 album, Spirit Catcher. With his wide leaps between long tones and a sometimes generous use of space, Smith nods occasionally to 20th century European concert music. But he's also one of the modern improvisers most grounded in African-American vernaculars. He's the stepson of Mississippi bluesman Alex Wallace and played for a spell in Little Milton's blues band. Smith's projects are all over the map, but often have this much in common with the blues: the byplay between a strong voice, his horn in this case, and percussive strings. Elsewhere on Spirit Catcher, those strings are three concert harps played by the simpatico Emmanuel Sisters. Wadada Leo Smith abstracts from the blues. There are echoes of Japanese kodos and Gambian koras in those harps. But I can't think of any other music that sounds quite like that. Smith makes it all personal. On his other new reissue on the Nessa label, 1985's Procession of the Great Ancestry, he and vibist Bobby Naughton play in a quartet plus guests. On two numbers, they're joined by Chicago blues guitarist Lewis Myers. Smith puts down his trumpet to sing Who Killed David Walker in the great tradition of mumbling Mississippi bluesmen.
I say who? Who killed David Walker? I say who? Who killed David Walker? Sad old day when they walked him off the face of the earth.
In the 20-some years since then, Wadada Leo Smith has expanded his audience by reviving electric Miles Davis music with guitarist Henry Kaiser. On half of the new Smith double disc, Spiritual Dimensions, he's surrounded by strings. His band Organic has two basses, a cello, and a gaggle of electric guitarists, including Wilco's Nels Klein. The band can recreate Miles Davis's 70s funk with eerie fidelity, but they also put their own spin on the idiom. That's powerhouse drummer and longtime Smith ally, Faron Akloff. Faron is also on the other half of Wadada Leo Smith's Spiritual Dimensions in his Golden Quintet with Vijay Iyer on piano and John Lindberg on bass. This band can evoke Miles too, but the reggae beat is their own twist. In most of these settings, Leo Smith's trumpet is the calm eye of the storm. The sound is raw but lyrical, full of big gestures but intimate somehow. He's not the most technical player, but he's very expressive. In all that, Smith recalls the late Don Cherry. That trumpeter had a very different sound, but was also a musical nomad at home in all sorts of situations. When it comes to making music with the right ideals, Wadada Leo Smith couldn't be in better company. Thank you.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air.